Good evening, I'm Kristen Kay, and this is Aspen Public Radio's rebroadcast of an earlier session from the Aspen Institute, CBD, Hype or Hope? Support for this broadcast of the Ideas Festival comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Council, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com. Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from the Ute Mountaineer, a family-owned and operated outdoor specialty store serving the Aspen area since 1977. The Ute offers clothing, equipment, and footwear for hiking, running, backpacking, and climbing. More information at utemountaineer.com. And from the Red Brick Center for the Arts, offering week-long youth summer art camps, such as comic book design, printmaking, papier-mâché sculpture, jewelry making, and more. Registration is open online at redbrickaspen.com. And from Pitkin County, introducing PACT, the Pitkin Area Co-Responder Teams program, pairing mental health professionals with law enforcement, inviting you to a kickoff celebration with food, music, and more Friday, 4 to 6 at the Aspen Fire Station on Hopkins. More at pitkincounty.com/PACT. We go now to a rebroadcast of a session from the Aspen Institute, CBD, Hype or Hope.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for coming tonight. My name is Erica Van Boxtel, and I am the Associate Director of Communications here at the Aspen Institute. Tonight's panel is about all things CBD. So from beauty products to smoothies to even pet food, it seems like everywhere you turn, there's a new CBD product. Some say that CBD can help with anxiety, high blood pressure, and many things. I've even heard that it can help with the pain or reduce the pain of high heels, so the jury is still out on that one. What is CBD? Why is it so popular? Are there health benefits? And what does science tell us about CBD? I'm excited to introduce tonight's moderator, Matt Laszlo. Matt Laszlo is a DC-based journalist. He has covered a wide range of topics, including CBD, as well as campaigns, and all elements of federal policy. He writes for Rolling Stone, Vice News, and has contributed pieces to The Atlantic, NPR, and so many more. He's also a political communications professor at Johns Hopkins. So without any further ado, I'm going to let Matt take it over and introduce tonight's panelists.
Thank you. And I'm now also a correspondent for Vice News Tonight on HBO, and I signed the contract 2 weeks before it was announced that they no longer have that relationship. But tears. Can we start with a quick poll of all you? Who here has taken CBD? That's about everyone. Who here has taken THC? Who is on CBD right now? And I guess I am as well, but we'll get to that in a minute. So I've covered politics on Capitol Hill for 13 years. One of my clients is Rolling Stone, who I cover drug policy for. And for me, the veneer of all that is the raging opioid crisis that we have. It's just tragic and undiscussed. And kind of hidden. It's becoming a little more out there in the open as it's striking a lot of our families. Just this week, one of my interns lost a brother to an overdose. Earlier this year, I lost an aunt to an overdose. So it's slowly impacting all of us. Then we also have these long wars, and we have all these troops suffering from PTSD, and a lot of other people suffering from PTSD. So there's a lot of questions and there's a lot of claims out there that CBD is the answer, that it's the silver bullet. Tonight we're gonna test some of those claims. But before I let them introduce themselves, do we need to start the clock? Because I don't have a clock. Thank you. But so my biggest claim to fame when it comes to drug policy is in my 13 years on the Hill, I was the first reporter to ever ask Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer about marijuana policy. This was last year, right before they passed the Farm Bill, and, the first reporter I know of, at least at that. I'll take it. But Chuck Schumer had come out, and he had supported Mitch McConnell's hemp provision in the Farm Bill, which is why we now have CBD legalization. So I, as the jerk of a reporter I am, I asked Mitch McConnell, and he's majority leader, so he goes first at their Tuesday press conferences. I asked him, hey, now that Chuck Schumer's endorsing your bill, are you going to endorse his bill to decriminalize marijuana? And his exact quote, he got really heated and mad. He said, it's a different plant. It has an illicit cousin, which I choose not to embrace. But Mitch McConnell, who's very anti-THC and anti-marijuana, was very for hemp, and is the reason it's now law. But now we're finding that there's actually THC in a lot of CBD products, which is raising a lot of questions, which we're gonna try to get to tonight. So tonight we just hope to pull the veil back a little bit and look at the science and the lack of science surrounding a lot of these products that are being sold right out there, that are being sold right down the street, soon that are gonna be sold at Quick Mart and at Walmart, and they've already are at Costco. But I'll let you all introduce yourselves.
Great. I'm Mallory Laughlin. I am an assistant professor of psychiatry at UC San Diego in the School of Medicine, and I'm a research scientist in Veterans Affairs. My lab is at San Diego VA, which maybe is a little shocking to you all that I'm up here talking about cannabis, and I work at VA. But I'll explain that a bit of kind of how I got into that space. My whole research background is in cannabis. When I went to graduate school, it's actually kind of crazy. When I went, it was prior to legalization for rec, so several states had legalized for medicinal use. And I really wanted to study what differentiated problematic from non-problematic users, because I thought, coming down the pipeline, we're going to see legalization. We should probably know who's going to have a problem and who's not, since folks will be using this recreationally. When I went out to interview for grad school, I was explicitly told by my mentor, who, by the way, is High Time Magazine's Ask Dr. Mitch, so of course he took me. But when I interviewed with him, he actually said, if you want to be a grant-funded researcher, do not do this field. Don't work with me. And I said, I'll take the risk. So I worked with him, 10, 12 years later, a little scary to think that. I actually just got funded the first cannabinoid clinical trial ever funded by VA, which we're conducting at the San Diego VA right now. That's for cannabidiol, which we're using right now. We're testing as an adjunctive to psychotherapy as a treatment for PTSD in military veterans. We're enrolling right now. How I got into that was I went from obviously looking more at recreational use to looking at medicinal use, because my PhD was in clinical psychology. We have to do, at the end of our PhDs, we do a year of just intensive clinical training. I specialized in PTSD, and when I was working with these veterans, a lot of them were telling me they were using cannabinoids, and actually a lot were talking about CBD, which is shocking, but just a few years ago, people didn't actually know what CBD was. So when I was hearing this from my veterans, they were talking about using this, they were talking about self-treating their PTSD symptoms. And that was what got me really interested in the more therapeutic space. So, again, my background is both recreational and medicinal, but right now really more focused on medicinal application.
Great. Hey, everybody. I'm Marcel Bonmiller. I'm at the University of Pennsylvania as an adjunct, as well as at Canopy Growth Corporation as the global scientific director. I've been a cannabinoid researcher for 18 years or so. Started at the University of Vermont. I'm a clinical psychologist by training, then went out to California, worked at the Department of Veterans Affairs for 9 years, I think, as well as Stanford, where I got my postdoc. And then was tired, right? I mean, this is the issue of funding, is sort of the background of this, that it's pretty difficult. It's gotten a little bit better, but difficult to get funding for this type of work. And a lot of cannabinoid researchers really, wanted to study cannabinoids, but only could get funding for dependence and abuse, right? Like negative consequences associated with use. And so a lot of us did that work. And it's an important area of work, because there are some folks that don't do well when they used high THC products, et cetera. But there is also this therapeutic application, and people weren't that receptive about this topic. Again, not until that long did anybody even really know what CBD was. So I left and I went into pharma because I did some consulting for cannabinoid pharmaceutical companies and hemp companies in the US, because these are people that were actually, you know, invested in learning more about therapeutics. I went to Zenerba Pharmaceuticals, where I was director of cannabinoid therapy. They do transdermal synthetic CBD for a couple of years, and then had this opportunity when a friend and colleague, Mark Ware, joined Canopy as chief medical officer, joined him, and now I'm in the sandbox, which is kind of fun from a therapeutic angle.
My name's Hunter Land. I am associate director of cannabinoid research, also at Canopy. I've been in research about 17 years and really focused on cannabinoids for about seven. I was the first research employee in the US for GW Pharmaceuticals. For you guys that don't know GW, they have FDA-approved CBD for specific types of refractory epilepsy in pediatric populations, as well as LGS. So I started that program. I did the study design, established that group, learned a lot about cannabinoids in those 7 years, some really robust research going on in that area, and then recently transitioned to work with Marcel and Mark Ware over at Canopy.
All right, so let's just start tonight with a simple yet complex question. What's the difference between THC and CBD? You're next to me, so I'm making you go first.
Oh, okay. I'll start with, so at the broadest level that I think most people know is that, so CBD is one of the non-intoxicating components within cannabis, whereas THC is the one that you more think of when you think of getting high. I'll let you guys go into more detail. This guy probably can really go into detail. Some of this guy.
Go for it.
Yeah. So to bring that a little bit further, I want to point out one important thing. So your body does have cannabinoid receptors, specifically cannabinoid receptor 1 and cannabinoid receptor 2. THC binds to cannabinoid receptors. CBD does not. So when you hear someone say it binds to CB2, that's primarily in immune cells. That has nothing really to do with CBD. CBD is non-intoxicating. It does not bind at those same receptors, so it doesn't downregulate certain neurotransmitters that cause intoxicating feelings associated with CBD, or excuse me, with THC. So completely different mechanisms. CBD has about 65 targets, molecular targets, and none of those are ones that cause euphoria.
Yeah, so I think that's been said, right? They just have very different effects. And so when we just talk about, I think, stepping back more broadly, what I like to say is, you know, and I think it's a good intro to this, is cannabis is not cannabis is not cannabis, right? When we talk about the plant, this is something that has 120 different chemical, like molecules in it called cannabinoids. Beyond those cannabinoids, there are also terpenes, flavonoids, all sorts of different things. And all of these things have independent effects. And CBD and THC are just two of the 120 cannabinoids in the plant. Most of the work has been done on THC historically, and CBD has really gotten the limelight within the past 5 to 10 years from a research perspective. And then there's the other 118, which we know almost nothing about.
Can I actually jump in too? There's one point of clarification that I feel like I hear all the time that drives me nuts, and I wonder if it drives you guys nuts too, about, so sometimes you'll hear CBD is the non-psychoactive component of cannabis. That is not true. It's not intoxicating, but we wouldn't be studying it for mental health if we thought that it didn't have psychoactive effects.
That's but explain, flesh out that word, psychoactive.
Yeah.
Because I think it's misunderstood.
Yeah, so psychoactive just means that it's crossing into the blood-brain barrier, it's having activity that's causing a change in behavior or sensory perception. So if you think of something like an SSRI, for like an antidepressant, that's psychoactive. It's changing your behavior, it's changing your mood. So psychoactive doesn't mean it gets you high.
Now, so what do we know? What can you guys say definitively about the health benefits of CBD right now that are scientifically proven? Because we all know the anecdotes, but anecdotes are just that.
I'll start. So not a whole lot, honestly. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting. So with CBD, from a therapeutic perspective, we have, you know, there's kind of different standards of evidence, right? And, you know, our kind of high gold bar is placebo randomized controlled trials. Those studies have really happened in CBD only in relation, at any large scale, only in relation to a couple types of rare pediatric seizures and adult seizures, Dravet and Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. The beyond that, it's really like there's a huge drop before you get to any other sort of research that's been going on. So if you look at anxiety, for example, there have been a few studies from South America that have looked at social anxiety and different levels of CBD and the impact on social anxiety. If you look at, if you start moving down the list, I mean, it gets pretty scant pretty quickly. When you get into depression, it's all preclinical work, all just rodent models is all we know. Inflammation, very little that's been done. Pain, very little that's been done. And you could just go down the list. So again, all of the claims and everything like that are, you know, the bar is not there in terms of our understanding of it. And what I would say is that that is important because, I mean, anecdotal reports are very important in terms of kind of guiding us in terms of where we should put money into these large-scale trials. But the problem is the placebo effect is so big in CBD and cannabinoids more broadly that, you know, there are people, and you can tell stories about this, but, you know, from, you know, research, I'll give you one example. You know, there are kids with, you know, seizures, having multiple seizures that just go into full-on remission on placebo just because of that expectation of CBD, and that's pretty powerful. And so when you think about, you know, somebody tried this and it helped them, and somebody tried this and it helped them with that, how much of that is actually the drug or the placebo? It's, you need to parse that out in clinical trials.
Yeah, I would just add, I think that we're excellent at treating rodents and possibly fish. A lot of work with rodents and fish, not so much with humans. But to Marcel's point, we do have lots of antidote, and there's some phase 2 work in areas like schizophrenia, maybe as an anxiolytic. But as Marcel mentioned, placebo control is important. So we can see what is, you know, just this placebo effect and how that compares to active drugs. So there's a couple different ways you can design studies to look at those areas, but I think just as you said, very little work broadly. It doesn't really match up with the claims, but that doesn't mean it doesn't work in those areas. It just means that we don't have really robust data in those areas.
And to push you on that, especially with people with epilepsy and epileptic children, which is just so heart-wrenching to see all the seizures they go through, would you, in that situation, give your children CBD as the end-all be-all?
So, you know, I have to say, I try to maintain objectivity, but I'm biased because I designed and ran those studies. But clearly, the most robust data we have around CBD is for refractory epilepsies and pediatric population. These are very severe children. They've failed, you know, 10, 14 medications sometimes. They're usually taking 4 or 5 other medications. It's a really, really sad condition. And we do see pretty robust reduction in seizures where nothing else has reduced seizures in those populations. The part that bothers me a bit is, you know, this is dose specific. So the doses that you use in clinical trials are somewhere probably between 10 and 100 fold greater than what you see in typical markets. So I don't know if a really, really low dose is great for seizure control. And I don't know what it does to, you know, the person that just had their first seizure and instead of taking a regular pharmaceutical, they take CBD. I don't know how effective that is, but at low doses, I would say it's more benign than most other anti-seizure medication. So that's what we know.
The tough part, though, is like most people aren't using it for seizures.
Right.
Like, and I was telling all of them, like at my coffee shop in the morning, my barista is like, do you want some CBD in your coffee? And of course, I was like, what is it? How much are you putting in there? But when I listen to them talk, like they're selling it to everybody as if it treats everything from warts to Alzheimer's. And so I think that's where, a bit of the confusion lies is we do have great data for certain, like 2 conditions.
It doesn't regrow hair, I can tell you. Try that one.
So what don't we know about CBD right now, as in what are the big questions that you're researching or that you really think the whole field needs to find answers to ASAP?
There's a long list, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, potential anxiolytic effects have broad utility. And so anti-anxiety.
Yeah.
So those potential areas. So that's that overlaps with things like PTSD and other conditions, depression, schizophrenia, fear extinction, those types of things. And two experts on the stage with that. I think pain is something that is important. Certainly unmet need, especially when you look at opioid crisis. Maybe MS, maybe other neurological conditions. There's tons of stuff that we can do with CBD. We just need to spend time to do it.
I think the psychosis story is an interesting one.
Yeah,
because this is a situation, and this is where you get, again, thinking about the balance of CBD and THC in terms of effects. You know, we know, I'll use anxiety as an example. High doses of THC, generally speaking, can increase anxiety. High doses of CBD have the exact opposite effect. When you move this over to psychosis and schizophrenia, you actually see associations, particularly among certain folks that have genetic vulnerability, THC increasing your risk of developing schizophrenia or psychosis. And now, right now, people are studying CBD as a potential treatment. And like Hunter said, there's some really interesting phase two trials that are going on trying to explore that. So I think that's an important area. And I think there are a couple. Like, I think, you know, if we sat down and thought, you know, what are the top conditions to which we think this could work or be the next big thing, I think we'd probably come up with a handful that are at least where there's enough evidence to start to get the ball rolling and, you know, make sense from a, you know, from pursuing it in a larger scale.
Right. But I think it's important also to recognize that, like, what we're talking about when we talk about we want to do these clinical trials, to go back to Hunter's point about, like, dosing. I mean, what we're talking about when we're talking about testing something like CBD, that's not necessarily, we're not necessarily testing what everybody in this room, when they were all raising their hand, is necessarily using. Because the products I know I have access to as a researcher to be able to actually dose in a clinical trial is not actually what's commercially sold. And certainly in different doses. So we're talking in the hundreds of milligrams per day. For my study with PTSD, we're dosing at 600 milligrams a day. I'm guessing that's not what most of you are taking. I'm guessing maybe you have 600 milligrams in the bottle of CBD that you have. So there's a big mismatch between what we're talking about when we talk about testing and these clinical trials in humans and what actually is being done, you know, what is being used.
Can you elaborate on that with what you're finding and studying with PTSD?
Sure. So, well, there's a few angles there. So Marcel and I both worked at National Center for PTSD. He was actually my postdoc mentor before he left and ditched out of VA. while we were there, we did quite a lot of work just looking at what veterans are actually using to self-treat their PTSD symptoms. We actually had a paper that was just published looking at a group that gives, Santa Cruz Veterans Alliance data, actually gives free cannabinoid products to veterans in the state of California who have a medical card. And it's really great, rich data for us because price is not an option. You know, what we're talking about with dosing of CBD, that's really high doses. That's very different than THC, where you would be dosing in just a few milligrams versus hundreds. So cost is a big barrier with treatment of CBD. So we wanted to see if cost isn't an issue, what are people actually choosing and using? In that data set, they were using very high THC cannabis, and they were using a lot of it. So it wasn't necessarily matching up with a lot of our preclinical data that was suggesting that actually it looks like really high CBD or very, very low THC might actually be kind of the ticket for some of these processes that underlie PTSD pathology, like anxiety, like extinction learning, which we can go into later. There was a mismatch between what the preclinical data was suggesting, which was all that really was done. We had a few open label studies with humans, but we didn't have any big scale randomized control trials. And yet, folks were like, it's proved effective for PTSD. So then they're going out to their dispensary and picking up, you know, high THC products. So there's a big mismatch between what people use and what we're actually studying and what the preclinical signals are suggesting.
And I'd add to that, so when you look at the trials that are done, you know, with CBD in these, you know, large studies that have been talked about before, studies that are going on, phase two, et cetera, people are using almost pure CBD. And at these levels, right? So when you look at Epidiolex, what they did, right, I think you're 98, what is the,
yeah.
something like that, percent pure CBD for other studies, and it's essentially 100% pure, or pretty darn close to 100% pure CBD. And what we found, right, in the literature is that it's hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of milligrams to dose that. What I would add, and I think this is sort of the contentious piece, right, is this sort of botanical, whole plant, right, full spectrum that's more important than isolated CBD, you know, and the hard part of that argument is that what is that other stuff that's important? You know, they're like, oh, you need CBD and the other stuff. Well, that's a lot of other stuff. And it's and it's hard to really like think of like what levels of that other stuff. I mean, that's not that scientific of an approach, right? And so all that said, you know, if you fix this, this was something actually just a couple days ago, a colleague of ours, Stacey Gruber, up at McLean Hospital, just presented some data where she had much lower doses, and this it's an open label study, mind you, so no placebo control, so you have to account for that a bit, but she used significantly lower doses than we've seen in these pure isolate studies, and like 100 milligrams of CBD with a little bit of THC in it that was fixed, you know, and set. And she saw these pretty drastic reductions in anxiety, whereas in the purified form, you know, it's 300 to 600 or so milligrams of CBD. Now, who knows, right? I mean, this is just an initial piece of data, and I think us all as researchers are trying to figure this out. You know, like, does it matter? And if it does matter, you know, how much of whatever else in there matters?
Yeah, I'd just like to add to that, too. You know, there have been studies published where you look at isolated CBD versus a combination of cannabinoids, including THC, and in some conditions, you see benefit. So for MS and pain, you can see benefit combining them versus alone and at different ratios, and that all hasn't been fully studied. But in other conditions, like for instance glaucoma, CBD and THC have an opposite effect. So in those conditions, it's not a benefit to use both. So we don't know which conditions. And you know, for things like anxiety or at-risk population, THC may present a risk where CBD doesn't, and then other populations it may be a real benefit. So
for
those
kids,
are things,
right? Child
right.
Populations.
So we don't know. I mean, there's tons of I'll say there are studies that say THC is bad for the developing brain. I think there are questions about how solid those studies are, but at least presents the idea that there's risk. And you know, when you're talking of children, it's risk reward. And if I have a normal child that has ADHD, do I want to give them THC or not? And you know, as a father, I would say no. But you know, who knows what we'll learn in 5 or 10 years where we study this more robustly.
You know, I have questions though about like even with like the data we saw with Stacey about if it's really CBD that's driving any of that, because at such a low dose, CBD is not very bioavailable. Like, not that much is getting in your blood.
Yeah, so about 15 to 20% actually gets in your blood. So it's and that's dependent on consuming it with oil, and the effect is much higher if you have it with high-fat foods. So if you're just taking a capsule or a tablet or crystalline CBD, you're really not getting very much into your blood. So it's important to consume it with food if you want to kind of make the most out of your CBD product, get the most exposure. So, but again, we don't know dose, and we don't know, you know, how much of that's available. So.
Right. But like when I see that data, then it's like they dosed at like 30 milligrams of CBD. I'm like,
right.
Yeah.
I mean.
It's an empirical question.
Right.
I don't know.
Maybe it's the THC. Or maybe one thing is when you take them together, you change. There's a active metabolite. So when you break down THC, there's a different metabolite that also works on those receptors in the brain. And when you take them together, it seems that that ratio changes a bit. So that could be important for disease.
And when I talked to Hunter earlier this week, he said one thing he wanted all you to take away from this is the idea that there's no simple answer to any of this. It's very complex. And now I just got an email this week. Martha Stewart now has her own CBD line. Willie Nelson has his. I've got Willie Nelson's CBD coffee that they sent me at home. Mike Tyson is now invested in a CBD company. So some of those are trusted names. Maybe not Mr. Tyson. sorry, Mike. Don't hit me. But Hunter, can you talk about the nuance that's necessary in trying to get our arms around this subject?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of nuance. I think one is dosing, so individual specific. It's really this lipophilic drug, so it sticks to all your fat in the body. So, you know, there's this point where we don't even know really how to dose it. So it's not like Tylenol, where you take, you know, a certain set dose kind of for the general population. One dose, your dose may be different because of your body composition, right? Or maybe the disease state, or maybe the receptors that are important for treating that condition, you have to either go higher or lower in CBD. So there's just so much nuance to dosing and formulations and, you know, what fat carrier makes it most bioavailable or, you know, countless other conditions. So you can't just say, oh, take 20 milligrams of CBD every night and that's going to cure your osteoarthritis. Like, honestly, we have no idea what the dose is, and it's probably different from person to person, and it may work for some people and it may not work for others.
And I just to jump on this dosing thing, and osteoarthritis is an example of this, but you're seeing this now more and more, is that you also can't think of dosing as linear. So it's not like, oh, you know, other drugs, a lot of other drugs, it's a linear dose response. So you just like go up until you feel, you know, you get a sufficient therapeutic effect. It seems from a lot of studies, at least, that have been going on, that it's actually curvilinear, so that there's a sweet spot below which you don't have an effect and above which you don't have an effect. And you see this in CBD, and you also see this with THC and pain, for example. So again, like from a clinical trial perspective, as we're looking at this, you can't just say boom, boom, without like any informed thing. You have to almost like cover the range so that you can get a better sense of, you know, better likelihood of it, of trying to identify that sweet spot.
So this is for you, Marcel. So a 2017 study by the Journal of American Medical Association, they examined 84 different CBD products, and they found that only 31% of them were labeled correctly and that 20% of them had THC. So right now, currently, the FDA is not really acting very quickly to regulate this. Can you talk about that, the need for regulations and things for us all to watch out for?
Yeah, so not to like freak everybody out. So first of all,
but to freak everyone out.
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, there are some good people and good companies out in this space. But I would say that generally speaking, and this is a couple of years ago, and so things change a lot, but what we found is this, that right now the problem is that the CBD market, as it's in everything, there is actually no regulation at a federal level on any of this. So the safety of like when you buy a bag of Doritos or a Hershey bar or whatever, like, you know, it's got the ingredients list, you know that like it's gone through these checks and balances, it has like a nutritional facts thing on it that you can probably trust. If it says it doesn't contain tree nuts or peanuts, that it probably doesn't contain tree nuts or peanuts. That's not the case here. And so each state essentially is, right now the FDA has just stepped back. And so each state is dealing with regulating this on their own, and they're kind of having to create their own mini FDAs in each of the state, which is crazy. And especially with the lack of knowledge and the resources that it takes to do something like this. And so you have a lot of companies that are just cranking stuff out. And some of those things don't have as much CBD as they say they have in it. Some of them say it has more CBD than it has in it. You've got a bottle right there.
I went out and I did my research today, and I stopped in 4 or 5 dispensaries, and I got this one, CBD one, as a prop. And then the three of them looked at it as we were talking before. What did you guys find in there?
Butane. Extracted with butane.
Butane.
Yeah. So like,
as well.
What?
That details.
Right. Like, that matters. Right. I don't want butane.
Correct. So like this is the sort of issue, right? So like there's the cannabinoid content, like CBD, too much, too little, right on the money. Very little, very few places have it right on the money. Part two is, you know, some of them say CBD or hemp oil or whatever, and in fact they contain THC and they can contain a decent amount of THC. And then part three is contaminants, right? So like this is that part of the story. Pesticides, heavy metals, like you wouldn't believe what is in these products. And the research right now, we were kind of like one of the early sort of folks, and we were just focusing on cannabinoid content, but now if you start looking at contaminants, it's pretty scary stuff. And so, you know, again, it's not everybody, but, you know, if you think about like the balance, I mean, you can make a whole bunch of money selling something that you threw together, you know, and some and nobody's checking over your shoulder, you're gonna start to see drift, right? And especially with a product that's expensive to produce, particularly to produce correctly. So this is sort of where we're at in the market. And right now the FDA just a few weeks ago had a meeting in DC where they're trying to figure out what to do with this and how to deal with the fact that we have a pharmaceutical company where he was at GW, and we have, you know, a supplement market and folks that are selling it all over the place. And how do you manage those two things? And then also how do you, you know, regulate and control it? And I think really it's moving towards, you know, we need to regulate this like dietary supplements, and we need these things have to be GMP, so good manufacturing practice, you know, manufactured, and, you know, we need to hold up them up to the standards of a lot of other things that are on the market.
I'd just like to add,
yeah.
So I think it's a lovely plant. Cannabis plant is a brilliant, brilliant plant.
Me too.
It's really complicated, but some really cool aspects of the plant can also make it inherently dangerous. So cannabis is what we call a phytoremediator. It remediates the soil, so it soaks up whatever's in the soil. They planted this at Chernobyl to help clean up the nuclear fallout. There's heavy metals, so think of the forest fires in California, all that stuff falling to the ground. If you're growing it outside in that dirt, then maybe that's not the best idea. And then you have, you know, these bad actors that say, oh, well, I've got insects, I'm going to Walmart and I'm getting jumbo cans of roach spray and I'm going to just spray my whole crop. I think those are the minorities, but that being said, you know, as consumers, if you take these products, I would encourage you to get a certificate of analysis. So any product that you buy, look at their lab report. And I'm not just saying look at the CBD content and the THC. Look to see what are the heavy metals and what solvents they're using to extract it. Because they could use something benign like CO2, we breathe this is fine. But butane, I don't want to ingest butane. I don't think you guys should ingest it either. So I think really what we need to do is empower the consumers and say, hey, you know, we want clean products. We want, you know, like if I go to the liquor store and I buy a nice bottle of bourbon, I know what I'm getting. Don't usually visit Billy Bob and get the moonshine around the corner because, you know, I like my vision and I don't want to get sick. So, you know, my recommendation is if you buy these products, you know, get a legitimate lab certification. If they don't have it and the bud tender says, oh, I promise it's fine, it's great, it's organic, whatever, I would say that's probably inaccurate, to be honest, so avoid that.
And just to make this even more complicated, so a few things just to kind of know, even that lab report, you might not be able to trust perfectly. It's probably in the ballpark, better than nothing. But because these aren't regulated, it means that a lot of testing facilities, unless it's hemp-derived CBD, which with passing a farm bill, hemp-derived CBD is sort of legal in this weird space. I mean, it's legal, it's no longer a controlled substance, but not currently regulated by FDA, which means if you're a testing facility that is FDA compliant, you're probably not testing cannabinoid products that are controlled substances. And so, in fact, you're not. And so these testing facilities, there are some good actors. There are good ones that are like, we're still holding ourselves to account. We're holding ourselves to what would be the FDA standards, even though we're not regulated by them. But if you think about if your competitor's not using the testing facility that's exponentially more expensive, you know, that's going to be tough for you to actually kind of survive in this very competitive market. So that's also something that's really difficult right now with this kind of unregulated space is whether or not you can even kind of trust those testing results.
I mean, it's difficult to get a real lab with real test results.
Right.
And Hunter just brought up the bud tender. So if you're looking for CBD products or whatever, your doctor is now this person behind the counter without a degree in many aspects. I had 3 reconstructive wrist surgeries after I broke my wrist snowboarding in Vail a couple years back, and I learned after the first one that I needed marijuana in the mix. It cut my opioid use in half. I was explaining this to my primary care doctor, and she was terrified. She didn't know anything about this marijuana stuff. I was like, hey, read my article in Rolling Stone. So I'm educating my doctor. I mean, it's a little unsettling to have medical professionals not know about this stuff. And then also for us as the consumers, I'm doing my own regimentation, mixing THC, and then, because I didn't want to be high around lawmakers, I would take CBD. Who Why does? Because then I would take CBD before going to the Capitol. But then I'm self-regulating and mixing
opioids.
So that's a problem.
Right.
Yeah, so from a... So from the education sort of space, and this is always one that's fascinated me because we have very little education for medical school or other professionals that are out there on this topic. And we just actually did a study that with some folks in New York looking at physicians across the country. I think it was 300 and some odd physicians and talked to them about, you know, how comfortable they feel about, you know, CBD and THC and cannabis more broadly. And we know if they had and this was focused on anxiety and PTSD, but if they had a patient come in, like, what do they do? Do they feel comfortable talking about it? Do they recommend it to those patients? And this is a variety of different settings. This isn't just physicians in one type of hospital. This was truly decently representative across the country. And the majority of them said that they wanted to learn more and that they didn't feel comfortable recommending it because, you know, and I think the implication is, and what you see when you talk to these folks is that there's no, you know, they're used to like opening the PDR or whatever it is and having like specific information. This is how you start dosing. This is what the product is. I know exactly how it works. That's not the case here. We're not quite there yet. We're there with Epidiolex, but aside from that, we're not. And I think so right now it's about figuring that out. And then when you flip it to that, so then what do patients do, right? So they go to their bud tenders at dispensaries. And we did a study on dispensary bud tenders, and we found that the majority of them had training in retail. They're really trying, like truthfully, these aren't medical professionals. These are people that are pushing product in a lot of cases. They have their own sort of agenda coming to this. And we asked them condition by condition, what are you recommending? And then tried to match that to what do we actually know about this stuff to see if these things match. And they didn't, right? So like they're recommending things that I would say would be contraindicated. And again, this shows like the need for education in this space broadly.
Yeah, so just to add to that, I think physicians have nothing in the curriculum or on the board exam, to my knowledge, at least last time I checked with AMA, there are no questions or part of the curriculum focused on cannabinoid science, generally speaking. I think things are starting to be implicated or implemented with pharmacists, but not with physicians. So they're self-reliant to get information, whether that's from continuing medical education or from an online website or from, you know, their Uncle Joe that grows cannabis in Humboldt County. So, you know, so I think there's certainly some issues around where you get your education. And I personally really enjoy going to visit bud tenders because I learn a lot. It's unfortunately not accurate information, which is not good for consumers and sometimes can be risky.
But even like, so with the study we did with the physicians, one thing that I think kind of gives me hope for the future is the overwhelming majority of the physicians said they really wanted education in this space. And that's been my experience at VA. I mean, I do a lot of talks for different departments with people who are like, oh, you know something about CBD, come talk to this group. And there's so many questions because they're like, I'm getting so many questions fielded to me from my patients and I just don't know how to answer them. So I think there's definitely this openness to learning. And as I always say, application is just so far outrun our scientific understanding. And I think a lot of physicians and practitioners, like, we don't want to make recommendations with hard data to back it up, which is a good thing. But it means it's going to take us a while to catch up before you can kind of get that solid recommendation from your medical provider.
Just to second that, I'm actually working on a project right now where we did some polling of physicians, and it's kind of the same thing, where they're very interested in getting more education. But some physicians said, oh, I know a lot. Surprise. I'm not picking on physicians. They're a great bunch. But I wanted to kind of poll them, so I stuck in 5 questions to see if they got them right, and about 70% of them got them wrong. So even the ones that think that they're educated, there's still that learning curve. So some really good ones out there, but then there's also some ones that need to be educated as well.
And so we're about to open it up for questions. There's some people walking around with mics. make eye contact with them. There's a lot of you, so I saw his hand first. We need a mic in the front row. But my last question, which is probably on many people's minds, can you fail a drug test for taking CBD? It's a practical one.
That depends, right? So if you're extracting from a plant, so in the plant, even if you say hemp, right, that's not just CBD. There's always a ratio, 20 to 1, 30 to 1, naturally occurring in that plant. So a hemp plant, so hemp and marijuana are legal definitions. Cannabis is scientific. Right? So we've put limits. We said not more than 0.3% THC. That's what qualifies a hemp plant. If you remove the plant material, if I remove 95% of the material and I've got 5% cannabinoids left in some ratio, that's no different than if I remove 70% of plant and I have 30% cannabinoids, but you know it's higher THC, but the ratio is still the same. So you know, I think some nuance around what that term means. And if you're taking a whole plant extract and it has THC, you will probably fail a drug test. And if they isolate the CBD, then you probably won't. But that depends on what analytical standards. Are we talking dipstick or is there cross-reactivity or whatever? So I would say it's certainly feasible, definitely with plant extracts, full spectrum, broad spectrum, and less likely with isolate, but still possible.
And I think this is a really important point because especially now that hemp-derived CBD is legal, I think most folks don't realize that it can still contain up to 0.3% THC. And that, yes, especially if you're dosing chronically, absolutely, that could lead to a positive drug test.
And if you're in the military,
And we have data on this. We actually...
Yeah, are doing a study, like, you know, did this and, you know, tested folks that are just taking hemp extract and... they're popping positive left and right at pretty decent quantities because it's storing in your fat. And again, 0.3%, you're like, that's so teeny. No, it's by volume, right? So actually 0.3%, when you think about a milliliter of CBD or something like that in an extract, it's up to, what, 2.8 milligrams?
About 2.7,
2.8. 2.7 milligrams.
So 10 will get you high, so 4 milliliters will get you high. There's 44 milliliters in a shot glass. So if it's at 0.3%, you know, that's what a teaspoon. Yeah. So a teaspoon at 0.3% would get you high.
Yeah. This gentleman?
Thanks a lot for the panel. My question is about really low dose, like the CBD beverages and things of that, and particularly around not really dramatic use cases like epilepsy, but things like sleep and relaxation. And whether most of our conversation was about really high doses of CBD, is the implication that 10 milligrams doesn't really work at all for those things?
I think this is where, I mean, I think it's an empirical question, right? I mean, right now there
very
is no...
diplomatic.
Yeah, no, it is. Because, well, I think that there's, I mean, at 10 milligrams, I haven't seen any data to suggest it's doing anything, right? It's, if we're talking about 10 milligrams of CBD, right? Now, if it's 10 milligrams of CBD with 1 milligram or 2 milligrams of THC, that may be a different story. And again, where that threshold is, I don't know. Again, most of the studies have been in the hundreds, so, but with Stacy's study at 90-something milligrams in a day,
and she's
with small amounts of THC, she's seeing some pretty drastic open-label drops, so who knows, honestly, and this is why we're trying to, like, scurry, but right now it's drug companies and mostly drug companies that are funding this research. There's very little going on outside of that.
But if we, I think if we step back just a bit, you know, we're all focused on treating diseases, right? So what does that mean for the individual and individual health? And again, I'll second saying I don't know, but, you know, CBD is thought to be an antioxidant. It's antimicrobial. It may affect gut microbiome. There may be other pieces to that for health that could have utility, but that's really, really hard to study, right? So the truth is we don't know. I wouldn't rule it out. If you use it, it makes you feel a lot better, then I'm not gonna condemn you, especially at that dose, because I think it's got a fairly benign safety profile.
Yeah.
What were the 5 questions you asked the doctors?
Ooh, that good one.
Too.
You're
that,
hired.
That I ask?
No, the 5 that you implanted into the survey.
I asked, you know, off the top of my head, I asked, the first one was, does CBD bind to CB1 or CB2 receptors? So they all assume that THC binds to CB1, the one that gets you high, and CBD binds to the other. That's not true, and that's really important when you're treating medicine. One of the other ones was, you know, are there any risks with changes of drug levels? And at high doses, there are risks. And a lot of them responded, no, there were no risk.
Like drug-drug interactions.
Drug-drug interactions. So those are the two that come to mind. There were other three others, but there were certainly some misses there.
Go get one of these ladies. Thank you.
Hi, how are you? I often feel that my left brain talks to my right brain. On the one hand, I'm a drug development researcher in cancer and infectious disease. And on the other hand, I'm pain patient. And when I come to a pain doctor, they recommend, well, talk to dispensary, and when I come to dispensary, they say, well, blue cheese is a wonderful thing, which makes me just like absolutely livid, because I don't understand this thing, and number one. Number two, how could anyone dispense something that has no label and no content, no active ingredient? It just makes no sense. Where is it going? So how to make it, and putting it on a consumer, like look for the right laboratory, like what do we know? What does educated Amen. Consumer such as me, like as researcher, scientist, could know? I think, irresponsible, completely irresponsible. So this is where regulations should come. So where is it going, and what do people like you can do to help us consumers, including educated consumers, to have a better access and better access to information, and my pain doctor have better access to information?
Yeah, so I would say, like, when I look at the field and kind of where it's going, I think what you're going to start to see, and you're starting to already see it a little bit, is that there's a few companies that are selling product that are like actually invested in doing the research to find out whether their product works, and doing the quality and all the rest of that that's needed. And I think those companies are the ones that are going to be persistent and stay out throughout the market. And I think as regulations tighten up, a lot of the others are going to kind of fall by the wayside. So I think, like, broadly, that's what it comes down to. I think the FDA is going to come in and provide some regulations on this, which are hard and expensive to implement. And so there's going to be this shift, I think, as a and then I think coupled with that, this medical education piece, right? I mean, if you went to a pain doc and you were thinking about cannabinoids, like, you know, we know dronabinol, you know, has been done. There's been studies on dronabinol and THC and other things in pain. That's been pretty well done. So, like, yeah, it's hard to see that as a response. And this is where it's really the onus is on us and education institutions to step it up and do proper education to, yeah.
And just real quick, the FDA still has open comment period on this. So
it's just got extended. I think it's till July.
Yeah, so 14. Send them your anecdotes, because a lot of anecdotes.
You can write in to the FDA. They're, yeah.
And pardon me, I cut you off.
And just to add, what we can do to help this is you guys could invite us back next year.
He just wants to come back to us.
I just want to
come
back.
No, I was going to say, I mean, the really tough part is, because like I said, I'll go and I'll do these like talks for physicians, and just like you know, they want concrete answers. Like, if you're working in primary care, it's not like you're immersing yourself in cannabinoid research all day. So you want to know, like, what is it I can actually tell my patients? And as you've heard, all of us kind of dancing around, we don't know. It's a really, really nuanced area because, as I said before, application just way outrunning scientific understanding. We're racing to catch up, and we are so far behind. So for us to be able to give any kind of concrete answers about dosing, conditions, anything, we need more funding.
Is there?
So call your congressman. No, okay.
Are other countries better? Because I know Canadian CBD was sold here for a while. Are their testing regimens better than our lack of them?
Well, I think when you have a sort of like federal government involved, you get better standards, right? And you see this in Canada with Health Canada sort of and overseeing this. So there are countries that are better at it than others, and I think the U.S.
Is that a smart thing to look at on the label now? By Canadian opposed to
the
Wild West?
Tying the canopy.
Yeah, yeah, well, there's that, but you can't, right? I mean, this is, you're crossing country lines, right? So there is no importation without a DEA import license of any of the stuff from Canada to the United States, legally at least.
Look at this lady.
Hi, can you talk a little bit about the different delivery mechanisms commercially available, such as we have gummies, we have tinctures, we have extracts, elixirs,
patches,
patches. Now we can smoke hemp flower rolled in joints.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear a little bit about that.
I would stay with, my recommendation would be to stay with oils, because we know the most about how they're absorbed and how they work in the body.
Which is different than tincture.
Yeah, which is different than tincture. So, you know, whether it's olive oil, hemp oil, MCT oil, I'm not sure that there's a real robust difference there. As far as like topicals, unless there's a permeation enhancer, they're not getting into your blood. That doesn't mean they couldn't possibly work, like capsaicin creams and other things. They may still work, but not because it's getting into your blood. So
it's more of like a localized effect.
It could be a localized effect, but again, that's not been tested, so we don't know.
Because CBD by itself or THC by itself doesn't absorb through the skin. And so you need these things to help drive it through the skin, right? Just having done a lot of work on transdermal application. And this is the thing, is like when you have these companies that are patches, lotions, I mean, I think for localized and, you know, where the application is, they can be very helpful. And I've heard lots of stories from lots of folks. But folks that are putting it here and thinking it's going to help with their anxiety or something like that, like that's a different thing, right? But there is, right? I mean, you have that possibility if you have transdermal. For people that can't swallow or whatever else, where you want that sort of systemic absorption. But most of the product, and honestly, there's no products that are out on the market. Anything that says it's transdermal that's out on the market right now, there's zero data to support that because they haven't done the studies to actually tell you that it is. So it doesn't mean a whole lot.
Because it goes back to, again, that the only thing that we can actually study clinically is our like pharmaceutical products, not what you all are buying.
So that's going to have to be the last one. You guys were a great audience, and we have an amazing panel.
This is Aspen Public Radio. You've been listening to a rebroadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival at the Aspen Institute. You can also find this discussion in full on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Support for this broadcast of the Ideas Festival comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com. Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from the Basalt Chamber of Commerce, presenting a summer concert series in partnership with Takah, Wednesday evenings from 6 to 8 p.m. This Wednesday, featuring blues rock artist Tinsley Ellis at Triangle Park in Willits. Learn more at basaltchamber.org/concerts. And from Clark's Market, with grocery stores in Aspen and Snowmass for more than 40 years. Specializing in fresh foods for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and providing parking and a full-service pharmacy for added ease in shopping. Learn more at 925-8046. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale. Your news, your music, your station. We now join Fresh Air.